Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Oh, no, don't get your hopes up. I'm really here. This is the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. It's day after Labor Day, 2015. This is, in fact, the 8th day of September, 2015. And I'm just in after a fresh reboot of the computer. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And I'm all specially back from doing something I haven't done in a long time. I.e., taking a night off for purposes of just plain old fun. Granted, the fun was had prior to the taking of the night off. When the rerun aired last night, I was actually on the road. Berg and I had left on Saturday afternoon, and we had wended. Is that a word? Yes, it is. We wended our way down toward, through Virginia, through North Carolina, and into the sandy, rolling hills of northern South Carolina, and eventually down to Darlington, South Carolina, all courtesy of Kath from Canada, and longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky. We took a road trip. It wasn't a road trip to go and tell people about mountaintop removal. It was not a road trip that was in any wise associated with any kind of advocacy. Being as I was entering South Carolina, I checked my politics at the door. Hard to do, believe you me. And Ferg went to his first and my second ever NASCAR event. Now, some of you may be groaning right about now. I wish you wouldn't. We had nothing short of an absolutely magnificent time. The word NASCAR engenders a lot of liberal, progressive disdain. In point of fact, yesterday, late last evening, in fact, when I posted a few remarks about one part of the trip, NASCAR was referred to by someone who ostensibly holds progressive positions as a loutish spectacle. A loutish spectacle. And it didn't quite have the the grandeur and the pageantry of a conversation between, say, Alice Waters and Hillary Clinton. But let me simply say that as spectacle goes, and I disagree with the idea that it is loutish. It is certainly spectacle. As spectacle goes in the United States of America, I can't speak for anywhere else, I think NASCAR probably takes it hands down. I mean, football games, pro and college, been there. Baseball, been there. Pro and minor league. Basketball, pro and college, been there. I'm a little short on hockey. But regardless, I think I can safely make the assertion that NASCAR is the biggest public display spectacle in the United States. And let me say unequivocally for the record, I think Ferg and I had more fun together than we have ever before had. It was a blast. Now, to be fair, I will note that I probably would be, I don't know if better off is the term, but you spend a few hours in college and anthropology classes, and you look at things in a different way. The great essayist Lauren Isley once wrote that a person who has studied archaeology learns to measure time by things other than clocks. That an archaeologist can measure time by a pile of old beer bottles out back behind a shed. And it's absolutely true. And anthropologists tend to look at human beings in terms of behaviors, materialism, things like that. And that's okay. But good God Almighty, did we ever have fun? The raceway there at Darlington is 65 years old. It opened in 1950. When the cars that were racing around its track still looked like a car you could buy off of the showroom floor, minus the numbers and the paint and the sponsors. I don't even know if the sponsors were on the car in 1950. But for those like that commenter on my Facebook page who see only loutish spectacle, two things. One, you can watch NASCAR and all day long on TV and take fun out of it or listen to it on the radio and enjoy it. But it becomes an entirely different animal once you see it in its modern incarnation. And I say modern incarnation because my one NASCAR experience went goes fairly well back in time to Talladega. First of all, the people at NASCAR bust their butts to make it a welcoming experience for both. It's family-friendly entertainment. It's just family-friendly entertainment at 500 decibels. And that's part of the excitement. Never having been to war, I cannot quite... I can't make this assertion with any certitude, but I have a feeling there are certain parts of a NASCAR race that are louder than war. It's that loud. And many thanks to Kath from Canada. The tickets were near perfect. Second tier up, fourth row, about 150 yards past the finish line. Right in front of pit road. Hell, we was right in front of Dale Earnhardt Jr. We was right in front of Junior's pit. Mm-hmm. But they really do. The NASCAR people try to, and there were grown-ups and children everywhere. And it was like seven rodeos, three circuses, two county fairs, and a church dinner on the ground outside before the event. And inside there was, okay, quick update. I didn't leave all of my politics at the South Carolina line. I couldn't help it. I took my zoom lens and scanned the infield a little bit. There weren't nigh as many as there have been in years past. But the rag of treason was on display, and more than a few people, and again the circus outside, there were on the back behind the back stretch, there were folks setting up their own al fresco booths to sell stuff, and probably the number one seller was the devil's diaper. Inside the gates, of course, there was Chevrolet with the NASCAR there, and Ford was there, and Geico was there with their, that poor old limping Geico car just couldn't get anywhere. Couldn't get traction, so to speak. And they were selling Bojangles chickens and chicken strips and hot dogs and the usual fare. It was pretty magical. You'll forgive me. I've been thinking about this story the whole time we were there. That much, I'll never be able to completely put that away, because I think of things in terms of telling the story of what happened and what not. Lots of Confederate flags sold. Some t-shirts apparently sold. A pair of middle-aged women wearing matching T-shirts passed underneath me through the little portal down the stairs to the concourse several times. The more they passed, the more they stumbled. And they were each wearing T-shirts with the devil's diaper on it. The rag of treason. And above and below the image, it said, "If you have a problem with this shirt, you need a history lesson." You're going to be so proud, because I didn't. You have no idea how badly I wanted to, but I didn't. I kept telling myself, off the clock, off the clock, off the clock, off the clock. Ka-chunk, off the clock. And no, it was not all behind the cornpone curtain accents, the people we sat immediately next to. We sat down, they looked at us and said, "How are ya?" And I said, "Dandy, how was the summer in Boston?" And they went, "Not so bad." Hope we don't have a terrible winter. And really and for true, they had come down from New England to watch the race at Darlington because it has some real history to it. God almighty, I think Richard Petty won the thing 10 times. Then again, I think Richard Petty won the Circus Maximus the Circus Maximus Bread Baker's Guild 400 72 times in his storied career driving chariots there. I mean, he's been around that long. Carol Baker saying, I tell people I'm white, just not NASCAR white. She says, car races are a blast. I used to love going to the I-70 Speedway. I am a motorhead. And this is motorhead heaven. And the more I sat and the more I watched, and oh my God, when they got to the driver's start your engine part and those engines fired up, I think there's something about engine noise that's hardwired in. There's a hardwired response in some people, because when they started the engines, Ferg just displayed a full-on giant smile that I haven't. I don't think I saw many of those on Christmases. It was sheer delight, absolute happiness. Little hairs stood up on the back of my neck. Chill bumps popped out all over. It was a manifestation of pure, raw, untrammeled power. Just a political note to people on the progressive side of the spectrum. If you would ever like to really bring about the changes that you want in America, a good chunk of people to convince of the rightness of your position would be the folks in the grandstands of that racetrack. And I'll tell you this much, because I did observe the crowd. With the exception of the two women I presume to be sisters and their stupid t-shirt, I didn't see just a hell of a lot of politics. Now, there was a right smart amount of patriotism, and we can have a conversation as to whether or not that was false or real. But I would take my $5 bill and I'd bet it on the real side as touching upon the people in the stands. Because those people in the stands very likely had people in the sandbox. Remember, George Dim Leader's war in the Middle East against the people of Iraq and Afghanistan was fought by people related to less than 1% of the country. But that less than 1% of the country, in many instances, is the 1%, the kind of 1% of the country, not that are billionaires, but that go to things like NASCAR events. Yeah, see, no, it didn't work out that way, and I'm happy it didn't. Earther pointing out the potential headline that we just barely dodged: Lib Talker arrested after delivering history lecture brawl at NASCAR. No, Bob. No, Earther. Hi, Earther. Not to say that, because I kind of got an elbow from Ferg. No, Dad, no. Because and I leaned over and I said, all I wanted to know, ma'am, I'm not offended by your shirt. I'm offended by that filth on your shirt. But it didn't. Because I was off the clock. To the extent that I humanly possibly can be. And Lord God, after 4 hours, the mixed smell of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, fuel, burnt rubber, and near proximity to not particularly good beer, I checked a lot of biases at the South Carolina state line. But I didn't drink so much as a single damn can of beer because I didn't have any I cared to drink. And life is entirely too short to drink bad beer. There was no small amount of irony involved in the fact that for the better part of the race, Budweiser chased Miller. And for a little while, Miller chased Budweiser. Those two great American icons, which of course by virtue of capitalism, because money, are now no longer owned by any sort of American concern. Lovely paint schemes. It was a retro throwback race for Labor Day. Kevin Harvick's car was painted in the scheme of the first ever original Budweiser can, which, now we all know the red and white of today, was gold. Of course, you had to open it with a church key. The Miller car was after a 1972 iteration, and it was in Brad Keselowski's. It was a white car with the red Miller seal on the hood. A beautiful car. Eric Almirola drove a number 43 car with the 1972 red and blue colors of Richard Petty. Hell for the. The degree of detail involved. Hell, the driver of the 43 car grew himself an honest-to-God, no kidding, Richard Petty Fu Manchu for the race. No joke. Young, what, 22, 24-year-old phenom NASCAR sensation, Kyle Larson, who is of Japanese American ancestry, his mama's Japanese American. Upon introduction, he came out wearing a long. You would probably recognize it as a Howard Stern wig, but he was actually doing homage to Kyle Petty, who drove the mellow yellow car in Days of Thunder. It was all, you know, there was a flyover by a transport aircraft. Yes, I know. There is an absolute celebration of militarism at these events. But that's because these are quintessentially American events. And this is a country that loves its militarism. Presentation of the colors. It was all there. The standing for the pray-in and Tanya Tucker came and sang the national anthem all a cappella, and even she was done up retro throwback, because even from where I was, I could see her blue eyeshadow. Mm-hmm. And the place was absolutely rocking by the time we got to the start of the race. And I kept looking at Ferg saying, you have never heard anything like this in your life. He goes, "Aw, Dad, aw, Dad, aw, Dad." And then they started their engines. And like I said, kid on Christmas face. And when it got to the start and everybody was all clustered and they blew past us in one big lump, like I said, it was a noise out of hell, like Satan's construction team had cranked every power tool they had up to 11. It sounded like a Balrog with a bad attitude. Interesting question coming from Jack in Shreveport. Jack asks, what was the gun-toting situation? How was security? There were cops all over the place. And, of course, they were the ones that were out directing traffic were just in standard kit directing traffic. The ones inside the facility had their bulletproof vests on and were halfway swatted up. I know that going through the gates, we were not wanded. We were not we didn't go through any kind of metal detector. They searched our camera bag, as they searched everybody's bag. But I think that was more in the way of making sure that everybody had to buy the expensive, you know, $10 Bud Lights at the track. Although somehow or another, the fellow sitting next to us managed to smuggle in some Budweiser Lime-a-Ritas. I know, because he offered Ferg one, and bless his heart, Ferg said, "No, thank you." Nothing more, nothing less. You know, Ferg's underage, for God's sake. But little details like that don't much matter among NASCAR neighbors now, does it? When we were all done and sitting in the bus riding back, more on the bus in a minute. He said, "Dad, I wasn't going to drink. You ever tasted that stuff, Dad?" And I said, no, because I have some self-respect, son. I have never tasted Budweiser, Lime, or Rita. And that's not me being a cultural snob. That's me being a beer snob. See, life is too short to drink bad beer above. David in South Carolina says, "I grew up 10 miles from that track, and with the sport from the 60s forward, I have not been to the modern version, so I do not know how the infield is these days." Well, I did. I used my zoom lens to scan. There were, I'd say, I didn't count, and this was right up to race time, broad daylight. I didn't count more than a half a dozen or so treason rags. And frankly, I was surprised by that. Now, I saw a guy in a treason do-rag, and they were apparently selling fairly briskly outside the track. They brought some guy in who prayed real good, but I noticed that he didn't pray in Jesus' name. He just tried to keep it ecumenical. Because, you know, someday some Muslims may want to come to watch a NASCAR race. And for all I know, there were some there. I mean, there's 80,000 people. Yeah. Ron in Raleigh says, "Retro throwback, you say. Does that mean they stopped all the black folks at the gate?" No, there was no small amount of black folks inside the stadium, in the concourse and in the stands. I know I ran out of fingers for counting. Kate wrote out on the front range, wrote just before airtime, subject line, no more Kentucky woman. Yo, isn't there anything else in the stacks all day and every hour, on and on and on, size, so many other subjects. I'm doing my best, Kate. I'm doing my best. Yes, in fact, there were Ron in Canada, many NASCAR Bobbsey twins, i.e., folks in their matching NASCAR kit, their matching NASCAR swag, wearing matching radio headset ensembles. There were many, and that would have been fun. But go figure. There's no. When that boy gets his head set on something, there's no turning him. He was hell-bent on being there and hearing the experience. He said, second NASCAR race, we'll get headsets. The first one, no. So we didn't. And hell, I've got tinnitus already from umpty gajillion years of headphones and radio, so I don't know. Maybe we didn't do it. Maybe I didn't do any damage. But it was a tremendous experience and a blast and a damn good race. And this, I mentioned anthropology a minute ago. For the folks who think that there's nothing more to NASCAR than a bunch of rednecks watching people go fast and turn left, which, of course, is the long-time knock on NASCAR, and I'm even guilty of it, saying such things as, well, you know, I prefer the kind of racing where they actually have to drive the automobile with chicane turns and whatnot, and hills climbing and that kind of, which is a fat, magnificent road-style racing. It's awesome. Road courses, awesome. Okay, I'll concede that. But as I sat there watching those cars go around that track, I ruin everything by thinking about them, by thinking about them. And it occurred to me, I guess I had a racetrack epiphany. Because from the time that we went up the trees because we had been chased up one by a hungry lion, only to be met in the tree by a napping leopard, human beings have yearned for one thing more than any other. And this is before even the idea of fire, okay? We have yearned for speed. Oh, the night vision of the predators would have been nice, but with speed, we could outrun them. We could outrun them in the daytime, too. With enough speed, we could run down the things that we wanted to eat, or that we wanted not to eat us. The more nuanced portions of human evolution in which we become conscious of what we're killing and what's killing us is a fairly recent development. But speed, raw, naked speed has ever been one of the few things that we as a species wanted and sought more than any other. One could say that maybe one could say that we domesticated as a species, we domesticated horses for the view. But mostly it was for speed. later on, the Hittites would harness those horses to two-wheeled carts for speed. And we bred the horses to make them faster and stronger, again, for speed. The Minoans and then the Phoenicians and the Greeks and the Romans added the power of human backs pulling oars to their ships and augmented it with sails, again, for speed. And we have ever sought more and more speed, whether in a cheetah-like sprint, or the little bit of speed that you give up for the endurance over the long haul. Speed. We crave it, we love it. There's something there's something deeply, deeply human about wanting to go faster. Maybe it's because of the brevity of our own human lives. Bless their hearts, those big old sea turtles get lives that can exceed 500 years. But they don't have much in the way of speed. A hummingbird, an elephant, and a human being all have roughly the same number of heartbeats in a lifetime. And they all define speed on different levels. The race may not always be to the quick, nor the battle to the strong. But as human beings, that's the way we bet. Speed. And so, at the risk of sounding a little George effing Will about it all, there was something on display, and it's on display at every NASCAR event, and in fact at every IndyCar or F1 event, that is elemental to our existence, and that is speed. And there is something heart-pounding and thrilling, and really untranslatable to television or video of any kind, about seeing that speed in its purest form down the straightaways, whether it's the front stretch or the back stretch, coming out of those bank turns. And without a doubt, we acknowledge that with those kinds of speed comes profound risk. You know, the people, 42 men and one woman, behind the wheels of those automobiles, those were not actors. Those were athletes. They really are. And probably not one of us could ever accomplish even half of what they do. And so this is just a little cautionary tale to us as liberals and progressives to sort of keep an eye on our own bigotries and our own prejudices. We, being liberals and progressives, we can be introspective like that. They're not so good at it on the other side. But you know what? if you could have gotten those 80,000 people in the stands there on Sunday into Bernie for President T-shirts, everybody from T. Rump to Hillary would have been shaken. And by the way, there was little politics on display, but of the politics that was on display, the politics I saw, were signs for Rick Santorum and a couple of Bubbas wearing T-Rump T-shirts, and I think I saw one Make America Great Again hat. But if we're going to be critical of having one of those, we're going to have to talk about Tom Brady, who had a Make America Great Again hat in his locker there at the Patriots, in his locker room down there where the Patriots play. Mm-hmm. Yep. Tom Brady. Tom effing Brady. No. When I said at the risk of sounding like George effing Will, no, I didn't mean that I was going to start insulting the women's. I meant waxing philosophical about a sporting event and the way he ruins baseball. Ron and Raleigh pointing out subject line speed. Hey, Bob, isn't it odd that as man's need for speed decreases, his ability to achieve personal speed increases? Check 100-yard dash speeds now and 50 years ago. That's interesting. I trust we're running a faster 100 now than we were 50 years ago, or not. You'll have to explain a little bit, Ron, because I can't go doing the research. But insofar as speed is concerned, what happens at these tracks is a technological marvel. It is the apex of our technological, of our ability to achieve raw speed and remain ground-based. You know, there's, of course, the supersonic aircraft. There's a different kind of speed contemplated over water, in water. And water and speed plays a little role in the rest of this story. I hope I'm not boring you all to tears. I'm I want to share when we have adventures like this. I want to share them. Because y'all go out and you travel around, you see places I will never see, and you share them with me, and I want to share in return. We got in about 9 o'clock on Saturday evening. Got a late start in the afternoon. Yeah, see, still thinking about it. And there's the ultimate contemplation of speed. Earther pointing out, we can't go faster than light, Bob, or can we? I hope so. And we do hope so. Because there's fast, and then there's fast. Yesterday, of course, being the anniversary of the first airing of the first regular series episode of Star Trek back in, 1966? Yeah. So thank you, Earther, for leading to our obligatory Star Trek reference for the evening. Carol asking, the cheater? That Tom Brady? Yes, that Tom Brady. Had a Donald Trump Make America Great Again cap in his locker. All this time, we thought he's a good liberal, didn't we? Or did we? I don't know. No, Bob and Ferg going to a NASCAR race is not exactly earth-shattering. But it was sure fun. I had a couple of free nights squirreled away on my rewards card with one of the hotel chains, and we burnt them. Got the last room in the hotel there in Florence, South Carolina, North Florence. That had a little delicious irony, because, of course, I grew up in North Florence, just not North Florence, South Carolina, North Florence, Alabama. We got there, we got checked in, had a desk clerk who, you know, if there were minor leagues and you move up to the majors in that kind of an occupation, this young man would be headed for the Four Seasons in New York, probably by next season, or the Waldorf Astoria. Or the Beverly Hills Hotel, whatever's awesome. Because he was just great. Because we got there, and you're supposed to be able to use this Outfits app to book your rewards night. So I got there, and we're sorry, there must be an error. We can't retrieve the vacancies. But it kept telling me there were vacancies at this particular hotel. Try again. So finally, I call, and I get a woman whose name is pretty obviously not Donna. And she's probably in Mumbai or Bangalore or Kuala Lumpur, or you get the idea. And she tells me that despite what the app says, that there are no rooms at the inn. Well, I walked my considerably sore, well, you know, just sitting and driving for a while, old pudgy white guy, self into the lobby there and politely asked the young man at the desk, turns out his name's Levon, and he said, oh, no, sir, we got a room. I said, for both nights? Absolutely. I said, well, I was hoping to use reward points. He says, yeah, and we'll be happy to have you, but you got to book them through the, you know. So I called, you know, I got Donna back on the line, and I set Donna down on the speakerphone on the counter. And I said, Donna, meet Levon. Levon, Donna. Levon, would you explain to Donna that you have a room? And he kind of hollered across, said, yes, ma'am, we do. And we want him to have them. And you almost get the idea that they're at corporate in Bangalore or Mumbai or where the hell ever, that they really don't want you using those points. But used them we did, and all because Levon was diligent in seeing to his task. So we got that taken care of, and then the next thing to worry about logistically was getting to the track, because obviously we were nowhere near it. Good 10 miles away. And I turned around, there was a big, bright, day-glow pink piece of copy paper there. It said, shuttle ride to the race, $20, and a phone number. And I'll be honest, I don't think about what the area codes are down there. So the next morning, I called the number, and yeah, they would come and pick us up at 4:30. And it would be more convenient because we wouldn't, you know, they'd fight the traffic and we wouldn't. And we wouldn't have to drive after we'd be exhausted from sitting in a 4-hour long race. Closer to five, really. More than five, 5.5. And got all set with that and thought that was taken care of. And it being Sunday morning, we got back in the vehicle and drove south to Charleston. I had never been to Charleston, South Carolina. I didn't want to be that close and not go there. And there's a ton of history there. There's a ton of history all over the place there. I mean, South Carolina's just covered up in history. I mean, one of the original 13 colonies. Granted, it was apparently settled by people with a taste for treason, but, you know, you're going to have that. Or at least some people with a taste for treason. Liberal in South Carolina says, you're doing great, Bob. I've looked forward to hearing your experiences here in South Carolina. What did you think of Carl Edwards' backflip? Oh, yeah. After he won the race, Carl Edwards climbed on top of his car and did a backflip off of it. And that's the kind of thing that really speaks to Ferg. And he just saw it and he went, whoa, Dad. Yeah, it was cool. It was really cool. And he ran a great race. Early on, he went down two laps because he blew a tire. And if you go down two laps on one of those super speedway affairs, getting back in the race is not going to be easy. I mean, Danica Patrick kind of proved that. During qualifying, she blew up her car. And so she had to race in her number two car. But I think the goddess of irony pays attention to NASCAR, too, because apparently when she blew up her car, she got all up in her crew chief's face as if he was the one behind the wheel when she took it into the wall. And she couldn't drive a lick. She screwed the number two car up real good and took it into the garage for 100 and some odd laps. Finally got it, you know, wobbling back out onto the track. Because, you know, you want to finish for a variety of reasons, some of which are economic. And I think she made it one lap around before the car started spitting out sparks all over creation. Next thing you know, the thing was smoking and she was done. We were right in front of the number seven car's pit, and honest to God, you want to give points for effort. That car finished, and it finished, I think, without a damn molecule of paint on the side. I can't remember who the number seven car driver was, but dadgummit, he spent all night being up close and personal with the wall. But anyway, so we went down to Charleston, and there were clouds lowering about the housetops to get all Shakespearean about it. The nearer we got, and we came down out of that sort of rolling hill country, down into the coastal plain. And we went with one purpose in mind and one purpose only. I wanted to do a few other things, but time was short. We had to get back to get on the shuttle bus. I wanted Ferg to see the Citadel, and I wanted him to see the USS Yorktown, and the Yorktown took precedence. So on I-26, well, not really I-26, but you come up over that great big swooping suspension bridge, the Ravenel Bridge, and off your starboard quarter, you can see the USS Yorktown CV-10 parked out at Patriots Point. From that distance, she's about, 4 inches long. And then there's one whale of a bridge. And the clouds were lowering over about the housetops. And the church spires and whatnot. We got over there and we got aboard the ship. And again, pressed for time, so we didn't have time to do it. But we were there to sort of honor the shade of my father and Ferg's and Marky's and Dude and Lila's grandfather. And most people want to see the flight deck, and most people ooh and ah over aircraft. There's a poor little destroyer, moored next to the town. The top of stacks don't quite reach the flight deck of the aircraft carrier. I gained a new appreciation for anybody who goes to sea in one of those. And we did. And in particular, I wanted to see a couple of things. We saw an F-6F Hellcat and an F-4U Corsair and F-6F Hellcat and an F-4F Wildcat and an F-4U Corsair, all of which my uncle flew at various stages of his career in the Second World War. Made himself an ace. But they have a memorial there to his ship, the USS Essex. And we went up one ladder from the hangar deck, and it was right there. I'm not sure what purpose that room served when she was at sea, but it had been converted to a memorial room to the Yorktown's big sister. And I know there's all kinds of gender insult and everything, but ships are she's. I mean, they just are. Don't blame me. Blame the men who go to sea in ships. And the Essex was the Yorktown's big sister. She was the first of her class that was launched, and Yorktown was launched shortly thereafter. She had been originally intended to be named the Bonhomme Richard after John Paul Jones's vessel, but the Yorktown having been sunk at Midway, they named her Yorktown instead, and it seemed propitious. They didn't change her name, and that's why she wasn't cursed. A lot of superstition at sea. So I'm told. But before we found the Essex room, stopped with a couple of old salts there on the hangar deck and asked. And I said, we want to find the Essex memorial room and want to go below to the boiler room, because that's where my father spent his war, his portion of the Second World War. And the old fellow looked at me and said, "You a snipe?" Knew the word. I said, no. My father was. He pointed at Ferg and said, his grandfather. And we want to see where he spent the war. And he said, 5 levels down. Enjoy the trip. And so, after visiting the Essex room, we toured around and went up to the flight deck. Ferg needed to see the flight deck. Of course, it was all modernized, relatively speaking. It was not the wooden flight deck that she had during World War II. And, you know, she'd been modified in the 1950s to have an angled deck. And they closed in the bow of the ship and gave her a hurricane bow. Again, technological advancements having to do not only with safety, but with speed. There's that word again. Took him up to the bridge, and he laid hands on the wheel at the helm. Took him around to the captain's docking bridge. And he was suffused with a sense of awe. And then we started making our way down. Down ladders. Yeah, there are no genteel staircases on aircraft carriers. I don't know if there are today, but there weren't then. Today, they probably have elevators on them, for all I know. And the elevators aren't just for the aircraft. But they're ladders. Then they're steeply angled. They're too steep to be considered anything along the lines of a staircase. And we went all the way from the bridge, which is up in the superstructure, down three levels to the flight deck, and five levels more down to the boiler room, down below the engine room. And there were lots of tourists. There were some tourists going through. A lot of folks don't go that far down. Not that particularly interested, I guess. On the way down, we went down ladders that passed underneath watertight hatches. Pointed out one to Ferg and said, "You know what that is?" And he said, "No." And I said, "That's a watertight hatch, son." He said, "I said, do you know what that's for?" And he said, "To keep water from getting below." I said, "No, not really. To keep water below from getting above. And if things get bad, if they get really, really bad, in order to save the ship, they will happily slam those things shut and screw them tight, and whoever's down there was just too damn bad for them." I said, "That was your grandfather's reality, knowing that down there he was completely expendable and would be sacrificed in a heartbeat to save the rest of the vessel." And so Ferg took that knowledge with him as we went further below. And we saw those cramped and confined quarters, the spaces where, on an identical ship, my father, his grandfather, had worked. And I dare say there was a certain holiness about it. Something sacred. Because my son was standing there looking at that boiler. And feeling no small amount of, not quite claustrophobia, but definitely the awareness of how enclosed he was. And by the way, the markings on the bulkheads noted that we were headed down to the boiler room of B Division. My father aboard the Essex, ironically, or by coincidence, served in B Division. So we were going down exactly to where, 70 years ago he was. And so it was like a 70-year snapshot. One 19-year-old standing in a place very like unto the very same place another 19-year-old had stood . The same unruly shock of hair. A lot of similar features. And at one point, Ferg said, "Dad, why do you reckon they sent Grandfather down here?" I said, well, son, you have to understand all he had was a high school education. Didn't have any college, so he wasn't officer material. But the one thing you have, and I explained to him, the one thing you have to understand about the Navy, or at least the Navy at that time, they were taking conscripts and trying to do as best with them as they could. In some instances, putting them to work in conformity with what they had previously experienced. West Virginia is a long way from the ocean, but for an 18-year-old kid in 1943 who had already known the insides of a coal mine, being five levels down in an aircraft carrier, seconds away from certain death, was nothing new. Nothing new at all. By the time the Navy got its hands on my father was already well versed in families whose dads or husbands never came back up out of the ground after the mine collapsed on them or exploded. And where the United States Navy sent my father, his grandfather, was somewhere where men did not come back after having the thing blow up or the sea rush in and engulf it. And I guess it happened on some vessels that you would take a kid who had known nothing but, say, the wide open spaces of the Midwest or the West, and stuff him down into the bowels of a ship. And I reckon that kid probably did fine. But to a certain extent, my father was a little bit of a gem. He already knew what it felt like to be deemed absolutely expendable. Useful for what he was, but completely useless in case of disaster. Just another name of another dead person. Because you see, West Virginia at that point in time, and up to that point in time in the new 20th century, which was not even half over by then, had made a specialty out of rendering men useless and worthless. By 1943, it was already a truism in West Virginia that a man had less value to a coal company than a mule. If that mule was not properly taken care of, it could get sick or crippled, or die. And then you'd have to go out and buy, and spend perfectly good coal company money for a new mule. Not so with a human being. A human being could be crushed in a slate fall, or killed in a blast, or die of white damp or black damp. Drowned, buried alive. And you know what would be waiting at the mouth of that mine the next morning? Another human being who wanted to go down there and take that risk for a pittance of money, because it was all there was. And so, coming from the coal mines of West Virginia, my father already knew just how little value could be put on a human life. And because he was on the very bottom end of the food chain, when some chief, not an officer, the only time an officer would have spoken to my father would have been a bad day for my father, when some chief looked at him, though, and said, "Boy, get down there." "Yes, chief." And down he went. But an argument might be made that he survived in part because he knew the score. At the tender age of 18 years, he already knew how much disdain a managing operation could show for a human being. And mostly, the bless their hearts, the United States Navy managed to keep my father busy enough that he didn't think about having the entire Pacific Ocean just beyond a few inches or maybe a foot of steel down there. And it was hotter than, and just on a plain old September day in Charleston Harbor in South Carolina, it was hotter than hell down there. One can only imagine what it was like with the boilers going and the engines running immediately above him. It was somber. It was sobering. And it was solemn. And the boy and I checked a box off the bucket list. You know, it's so funny. Americans and Westerners can look at other cultures and say, "Why, those people engage in ancestor worship." All the while never realizing that we do too. At least I do. At least I do. Because we are the product of those ancestors, and how can you not revere them, whomever they were? So we got back above, and we headed out. Although we had had a big breakfast, it took it out of me, and apparently I left my blood sugar level down there, 5 levels down on the aircraft carrier, after we left, so I had to sit down and suck down a bottle of pop and some French fries and, you know, whatever would drive my blood glucose back up. And along the way, I found out something else. Now, I told you when I got back from D.C. about the forced march that Agnes and I took over the 10 miles of the trails of the Manassas National Battlefield there in Virginia. Made it through okay. A little stiff, but okay. But I am a whole brand new, different kind of sore. I mean, pretty near crippled. Every step is painful. But it's not painful in the places I would expect to be in my legs to be sore after a nice long hike like Manassas. No, this is different. The fronts of my thighs are absolutely devastated. And it took me a little bit to think about it, and I realized why. It was the ladders. That's a different kind of walking. That's a different kind of climbing. And a different set of muscles. And apparently these have not been worked in a while, and I was sent a memo by my body that it's damn well time that I do. So somehow or another, I got to figure out a way to get real friendly with a Stairmaster of some sort and work those muscles. But my God, it was a great thing. to see that ship, and to put pictures of reality finally to 44 years worth of stories, things that I'd been told since childhood, stories that Ferg had been told. It was amazing. So, with no time remaining and having to get back in time to be picked up by the shuttle bus in Florence, we didn't have time to cross and see Charleston proper. That will have to wait for another day, beautiful though it is. We went boogieing back up the road, as I explained to Ferg, son, we are going to be doing 1 mile per hour lower than the speed limit all the way back. Ain't no sense in getting in a hurry. If the speed limit's 55, we're going to do 54. If it's 60, we're going to do 59. If it's 65, we're going to do 64. And if it's 70, we're going to do 69. Quit laughing, you perverts. And I continued to explain, son, we are in South Carolina. You will meet some of the friendliest people you have ever met in your life here, and you already have. But this place is brutal, make no mistake. And it has a constabulary that lives and breathes for people like us with out-of-state license plates, whom they see, that constabulary, as rolling sources of revenue. So we will do all in our power not to give them any reason to stop us. And operating under that philosophy, we got back to Florence. And we pulled into the parking lot of the motel just as my phone was ringing. And it was the shuttle company saying, we are here to pick you up. This will forever be known as the Great Shuttle Kerfuffle of 2015. Didn't have time to go back to the room, change clothes, whatever. Out of the car, onto the bus. Or so it seemed. But there were two shuttle buses pulled up there. And the first fellow that met us was kind of a florid-faced white fellow. And he said, going to the race? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, that'll be $25 apiece. I said, what? He said, did you sign on with them people over there? And there was a lady getting out hollering, he's my passenger. He is my passenger. And I said, well, I think I may have. And he said, well, they are out of North Carolina. They do not have a license to operate in South Carolina. And odds are they may get you to the race, but you will be on your own when you get out. And I'm only approximating the accent. I mean, you could pour that accent on pancakes. It was so thick and gooey. And the lady at the other bus would get hot. And another fella came up to me with white-headed, probably about my age, and introduced himself as, you know, sir, my name is John T. Smith, and I am the president of the South Carolina Motor Coach Association, and them people over there have no authority to operate in the state of South Carolina, and if you ride with them, you are taking your fate into your own hands. And so I said, well, I'm going to leave it to y'all to slug it out. I'm just going in here and get me some cash to pay the fare. Now, recall, I had signed on at $20 a ride. And so they, I don't know why, they followed me into the lobby. And I'm just standing there trying to get the cash out to, yeah. And they've commenced to setting up a terrible racket, bickering back and forth at each other over who has the right to be there and who doesn't and who ought to and who ought not, until finally the desk clerk looks across and says, I don't know who's right and who's wrong here, but I know this much. If y'all don't take it outside, I am calling the police, and I don't think they're going to care much either. Y'all probably all going to go. And I turned around and said, thank you, ma'am. And so they boiled back out of the lobby into the porte cochere, because I'm sure in South Carolina it's a goddamn porte cochere. And commenced to arguing some more. And you know, it was getting good because it was getting louder and higher pitched. If it had gone on much longer, it would have been an argument only dogs could hear. And I stood there and watched a little while because it was actually a rather freighted decision, because I did not want to, because it was explained to me by the folks from the legitimate bona fide coach company from South Carolina that one of two things would obtain at the track. Because one had to have certain licenses to be able to even get one's bus onto the property to do the drop-off. They said they will drop you off, and then they will tell you to meet them somewhere after the race, and they will either charge you another $20 to get back on and go home, or they won't be there at all, and I'm betting on won't be there at all, because they ain't got no license to do no business down here. And so I just sat back and watched and told Ferg to keep his mouth shut. I said, see what I was warning you about? These contentious people down here. And the one woman that I'd signed up with kept saying, well, I got papers. I got papers. And the other fella kept saying, show me your papers. Because the John T. Smith, the president of the South Carolina Motor Culture Association, it was demanding to see her papers, and he was quite certain that her papers were not in order. And I watched, and she kept hollering about how she had papers. And I went on a little bit of walkabout, just long enough to kind of get behind and around the van of the folks, the shuttle, the folks didn't have no papers. And I noticed, A, the North Carolina license plate. And we were at that time a rock-solid more than 100 miles from Charlotte. Or most anywhere else in North Carolina. And, two, there was no name of any transport company or anything on the shuttle. And so by the time I wandered back around, I noticed that she was admitting that, well, she must have left her papers somewhere else, and maybe they was in the van or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I walked back over to the florid-faced white fella who was right nigh beside himself by then, and he said, "All right, you sign up for $20 with these people, $20 with us too." I said, "Deal." He gave me us a little yellow wristband, and said, "Make sure you got this on when you get back to the bus." He said, "We will be waiting on you." He said, they try this every race all over NASCAR country. He said, "Well, hell, we transport people from Carnival Cruise Lines to the parking garages." I figured we were about 20 seconds from pistols at 20 paces, or maybe being South Carolina, daggers and sabers. So we all, and there's about 10 of us, we all got on that Lancaster coach's bus. And we watched the other van just kind of dry up and blow away. And then we made a circuit of the other hotels and picked up more folks. And noticed that the same thing was happening to that fly-by-night shuttle everywhere it went. And so we rode on, and I was still not entirely comfortable, because it had occurred to me that there was every possibility me and Ferg's going to be walking 10, 12 miles back to the hotel room after the race. And I was rethinking my decision not to drive, because I can always count on me. But we didn't. We was on the bus. Lady driving had been driving for that company for 7 years, and she drove school bus in, Beauregard County, South Carolina, for 20 years before that. And I felt a little better when she said, "Where y'all from?" And we said, "West Virginia." And she said, ain't y'all got a place up there somewhere called Bexley? Bexley, Virginia? I said, "Ma'am, it's a separate state and has been since the recent unpleasantness." She said, "Yes, it has, hasn't it? Well, I am supposed to take a tour group up there this winter for some kind of skiing expedition." I said, "Well, enjoy yourself when you get." And so we finally got there, and I tweeted out a photo of what I thought was a lovely little grace note provided by the goddess of irony, a little road sign advising hungry folks that they could go and get a bite to eat at a local Mexican restaurant, sitting right next to a Rick Santorum sign. And I knew we'd be all right, because I knew the goddess of irony was looking over us and keeping, and she was sitting on the whoopee cushion of her mercy. And so we got there and we parked, and they said, now it will not be this here bus. And I went, uh-oh. And they said, "No, we will have 4 full-size buses sitting here waiting for you. Just come right over here as soon as the race is over." And you know what? It worked out perfectly. The logistics of that place was managed to perfection. In, out, no. We were not wanted, and we did not go through a metal detector. I may have been sitting there with 80,000 Wyatt Earps in waiting, for all I know, but nobody decided to engage in any gunplay. Mercifully. I stuck out like a sore thumb because I wasn't wearing any NASCAR swag. I didn't have my junior hat on. He probably got the most cheers when he was introduced. They booed the hell out of Brad Keselowski. Apparently him having the pole was deeply offensive. But when it was all said and done with, and we walked out, we went over, and there sat the buses. We said, is this here the Lang? And it was marked big as life, Lancaster coaches or Lancaster, whatever. We got aboard, sat down, and sat the sit of the just. And after we got moving, we got through. I mean, it was like, it was, they just got us right out, and we were on the road, and it was easy. And I looked at Ferg, and I said, now all we have to do is make sure that this goddamn bus ain't going to Charleston. And all of a sudden, his eyes got as big as half dollars, and he said, you don't think. I said, I don't know. But pretty soon, we made a couple of right turns, and the next thing you know, they was hollering, Country Inn and Suites, and nobody got off. And then they hollered, Hampton Inn, and a couple of got off, and then they hollered, and we got off, and we were there, and we were exhausted, and took about an hour to unwind long enough to fall asleep, and got up the next morning, slept in. Wasn't no way I was going to try to get us up at daybreak to know. And told Google Maps we wanted to go home, and Google Maps said that'd be just fine. And stopped on the way out of town, and had a big bowl of shrimp and grits for breakfast, brunch by then. And Lord God, it was good. There is an essential dichotomy about the South. Lovely, decent people who can outcook anybody else in this country and probably most of the planet. Who at the same time choose to let themselves be governed by some of the most bass-ackwards, brutal, ham-fisted, hard-hearted, dead-souled political institutions imaginable to anybody short of Marshall fucking Tito. And just as we were about to leave, a blinking red light caught Ferg's eye. And he said, oh my God, Dad, stop. And I was like, what, are you okay? Something wrong? He said, no, look over there. And that blinking red neon light said two words, hot now. And it was the local Florence, South Carolina Krispy Kreme franchise. One of which we do not have anywhere near us, but Ferg has had in the past hot nows. That's what we call them, just hot nows. And so, even though our bellies were full of brunch, he looked at me and said, please, Dad. I said, how can I say no? And we crossed the road and got a dozen hot nows. He was full as a tick, and damned if six of them weren't gone before I even heard him breathe. So that was our adventure. We left here having filled up the vehicle. I mean, this would not have been possible without a lot of stars aligning. We left here purchasing $2.37 a gallon gasoline, but I had some points saved up on that card. I really am. I'm Scots-Irish. One time Ferg got glasses, and he was sitting around, and I looked at him, and I said, what are you reading, son? And he said, nothing, Dad. And I said, what are you looking at then through your new glasses? And he said, nothing, Dad. And I said, well, take them off. You're wasting them. But I had points on my fuel rewards card, so we filled up the 20 gallon gas tank for about $1.94. And once we got down there, gas was $1.86 a gallon. And it was 334.4 miles driveway to hotel. We added another 240 to it by running to Charleston and back. Averaged about 25 miles a gallon. Got home with a little less than a half a tank still in the vehicle. Had a magnificent drive. Ferg has become a wonderful, wonderful traveling companion. We made memories to last him until maybe one of these days he'll be telling my for all I know, my great grandson, his grandson, this story. And all of it is thanks entirely to Kath from Canada and to Sparky. With your kind indulgence for letting me do something I have not done in a very long time. And that is to just go and travel. Sheerly for the abject pleasure of it. And for that, Kath from Canada, and to Sparky, and to all of you, you have my very, very considerable thanks. And so half of the program is gone now. The other half we will devote to news of the day, whatever it is that might strike your fancy to talk about. The lines are open, 304-574-8178, 304-663-8178. Horn, 304-663-4676. That's the stress line. Skype to Skype is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. I did not mention it at the beginning of the program, but of course, as ever, we are listener-supported. And we try to raise $200 every evening. We pulled up short last week. It was kind of a surprise, but we did. About $70 short, so we've got $270 to raise this evening, if at all humanly possible. It would be very helpful if we could. The PayPal interface is under the tab Contribute at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. For those of you who prefer the United States Postal Service, the mailing address here is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801, with a gentle reminder that checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but should in fact be made payable to The Horn, as I never see him, and that's all stuff that Boss Man Wayne takes care of. I am truly grateful for the ability to simply put everything aside and just get away for a couple of days. It's wonderful. It's truly wonderful. But the swamp is never very far away, and it's probably time that we should head back into it. So we'll take a little break. We'll put out the caution flag for a couple of laps. Let everybody go to pit road. Then we'll reorganize and restart. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man, still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone. All alone in a time of need. Because he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and biting and riding on his horse. He's going the distance. No flowers, no flashbulbs, no wine. He's haunted by something he cannot define. Bowel-shaking earthquakes of doubt and remorse assail him, impale him with monster truck force. In his mind, he's still driving, still making the grade. She's hoping in time that her memories will fade. Cause he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and fighting and riding on his horse. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago, somebody left with the cup. But he's striving and driving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. Cause he's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone. All alone in a time of need. Because he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and biting and riding on his horse. He's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and biting and riding on his horse. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. He's going the distance.
Perfect, Ron and Raleigh. Thank you very much for that suggestion. So it is actually Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Michael in Madison says, Cake, I see you did not leave your DJ skills down south. Nice cut. All the credit goes to Ron and Raleigh for that one, Michael. Irish Dave, who forgets nothing, remembers all, says, but did that little Mexican restaurant down in Darlington even have any menu item number F? Sad to say, I did not get to try. I did not get to find out. I sated myself instead at the track with Bojangles' spicy chicken strips and some fried green tomatoes and fried pickles. Because they had fried green tomatoes and fried pickles. And I'm not talking about fried green tomatoes and fried pickles out of no bag of frozen crap. I mean, I watched them slicing them and battering them right there on the concourse of the Tyler Tower at Darlington Motor Speedway. Going back into the mailbag from during the filibobster. Tim from L.A. wrote and said, I wonder how many people caught you, what you said. You said there were no rooms in the inn. So does that make you Joseph, Agnes, Mary? Does that make you Joseph, Agnes, Mary, and Ferg Jesus? Well, at least you got a room at the inn and not in some manger. Hey, in South Carolina, would there be any wise men? Just wondering. Now. We're putting aside plenty of wise folks down there. I mean, we walked in to have dinner on Friday night at the last open restaurant. And I guess Florence has become a retirement destination because you know how you go into a city and they'll have some alternative weekly? I mean, in Atlanta, it was graffiti. And in, I can't remember. But anybody, everybody's got an, the Nashville Scene, I think. Free paper. And there's often some decent journalism involved in them. Well, in Florence, South Carolina, the free paper is a paper for retirees. News for baby boomers and seniors. I looked at that masthead and I thought, well, you know, that may be a redundancy. Because, I mean, I'm right at the tail end of the baby boom generation, and I think 64 is the official cutoff, isn't it? And your 1964 folks are 51 years old now, and so we've all qualified. Well, I mean, we're all old enough. We can't qualify, but we're old enough for the PGA Senior Tour, so I think that makes baby boomers and seniors just a little bit redundant. But, yeah. Kate says, thanks for the trip. Great job. Brought back many memories. Gentlemen, start your engines. Always brought tears to my eyes. Some of my best memories from teen years are from driving circle dirt in a borrowed car. Love to go fast and make noise. Some bragging rights. While in NOLA managing a volunteer center in the Ninth Ward, I had a flat on the company truck belonging to the church. I went to the breakfast crowd and told the guys I needed someone front and center to change a truck tire. First one to show up was one of Junior's pit crew. I haven't shared that with anyone because there's no one who would understand the import and why I smile at the memory. Many good memories of living in Alabama and the many races when Bobby Allison was flown in by chopper and all the old guys who were my heroes. Good times. Good that you and the boy had such a good time. And we did, Kate. We did. And thanks for the memories there. David in South Carolina points out NASCAR is recruiting for diversity. They want some drivers and teams from diverse backgrounds because it will expand their audience. I got to speak politics with some folks who did not look as if I landed from outer space. I also went by Einstein's house while up in New Jersey and pondered speed of light. So really cool to visit Princeton and Philly. David lives right in the neck of the woods where I was, and he was actually up in Jersey because his brilliant daughter got admitted to Princeton University. And so they were taking necessary supplies, including grits, up to his daughter in Princeton. So he was in New Jersey while I was in his native South Carolina. And yeah, you can. It's the essential disconnect of this country. But see, that's the thing. I am convinced that there is a way. There is absolutely a way. To talk progressive politics to the American South. But here's the fun part. Or the challenge, actually. There really is a cultural disconnect. Some of it will inexorably be forever tied up in race. Or some other word to replace that bogus baloney term. Bogus and baloney because the concept of race was invented by white people to describe people that they didn't want to share power with or whom they wished to oppress. There is a way to discuss progressive politics in this country with the American South. There actually is a progressive past in the American South. Some parts of progressivism were invented in the American South. But here's the rub. It's got to be done, for the most part, by people who sound like they belong there. You think there aren't progressive people in South Carolina? I know damned well they are. Dylan Roof assassinated one of them. And yeah, that says something too. We didn't have time to visit Mother Emanuel AME down in Charleston either, and I'm the lesser for it. But it is not a heroic transcontinental journey to get down there, so maybe again sometime, more time will prevail, will allow us to maybe do a little more cultural exploration that way. Hell, maybe even a trip to the beach, who knows. Asian be nice. Labor Day was yesterday, so that means it's the official end of summer. It's downhill to freezing our ass off now, at least around here. Another person I did not get to meet while in South Carolina that I wish I had, although we exchanged correspondence, he was entertaining guests over the weekend. Next time, we will not miss out, and that was, of course, Pastor Pillow, Eric Bjorn. As good and dedicated a progressive as lives down there. There are progressives in North Carolina. North Carolina was a very progressive place for a while, as compared to the most of the South. And maybe it can be returned through movements like Moral Mondays and the refusal of people to be disenfranchised by Pat McCrory and his owner, Art Pope. There was progressivism in Alabama. There's been progressivism in Georgia, in Tennessee. Hell, Nashville, Tennessee is absolutely chock-a-block with progressive people. Mm-hmm. There's even progressives in Mississippi, in Arkansas, in Louisiana. And God knows progressives by the millions in Texas. The question, the ultimate question, becomes one of how to get them to coalesce and how to talk about what matters to us. Because like I said, if you could get people walking around a NASCAR race wearing Bernie t-shirts, that would probably just about spell the effective death of right-wing conservatism in this country. I mean, bear in mind the Democratic Party and the DLC and the DNC, they like to pursue a strategy of going after what's called the low-hanging fruit. Well, I couldn't help noticing the peach orchards in South Carolina, and I got news. If you are a smart peach farmer, you prune your peach tree so that all your peaches are low-hanging fruit, and you can reach all the peaches. Yeah? Lesson? Maybe? Imagery? Metaphor? Simile? But when you talk about getting people to wear Bernie shirts at a NASCAR race, you're talking about the high-hanging fruit. You're talking about work. And that's one of the things I admire about Bernie. He's been to South Carolina. He's been to Alabama. He's been to Louisiana. And he is not content to simply let the South go. Because even though we're not talking about secession, we're talking about something similar to it, where we just hope we can muster enough electoral votes in presidential elections to keep the White House in the hands of Democrats by winning, California, Oregon, Washington, by winning Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, New England, Florida, and screw making any effort anywhere else. You get my point. Jack in Shreveport, see, a progressive in Louisiana. Shuttle kerfuffle is the subject line. There goes the wonderful free market at work again. Great. So it's up to you to figure out how not to get screwed all at the last minute. Maybe a little regulation was in order? Sigh. And see, that's the point. There actually were regulations in order. This was a protected market. And while I was made a little bit nervous by the Jubilation Tea Cornpones who were arguing the regulatory scheme, that's me, not them. That's my native distrust. But apparently there is, and of course there's a regulatory scheme in South Carolina for motor coach lines because they're going to protect their market. They're going to protect their market share. They're going to protect the money. Conservatives don't mind regulation as long as it's protecting the money. It's protecting the people that conservatives object to. But there's a way to reach the South. I just don't think that most progressives are very good at it. I remember that god-awful book from a few years ago called Whistling Past Dixie. Pissed me off to no end. Screw them, it said. And was very, very snotty about it in the process. But it can be done. And the fact that people are showing up for Bernie says that they will even listen to the message when it comes from somebody with, you know, one of those accents from up there. Michael in Madison said, "The kerfuffle over the quarreling cochiers sounds like a modern-day Samuel Clemens short story." It kind of felt like one, too. Indeed. Oh, God, we finished 2 hours of the program, and I'm kind of with Kate on the front range on this one. And I guess we've got to do the day, what may or may not be the denouement of the plumb worn out sister clerk Kim Davis story. And honest to God, druther not. But I think it's probably called for. By the way, above all, and I mean this was just a dissection that was absolutely brilliant. A general a good general understanding of the sister clerk Kim Davis thing, it can be had via our very own Carol Baker, To read it, go to hearwomentalk.com, H-E-R-E, hearwomentalk.com, and look for the article, Jesus is Not on Trial. Carol Baker has done a lovely job deconstructing the whole mess, which now maybe, oh dear God, let's just put it this way. Pastor, brother, governor, Reverend Mike Huckstery, diabetes sales, has recast himself, reinvented himself in the role of Jesse Jackson going and freeing hostages. Only this time it's persecuted Christian Kim Davis. And if you want a good joke, if you want a really righteous laugh, Christianity extends only so far, brothers and sisters. Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the Canadian-born anointed future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, showed up for the Sister Clerk Kim Davis rally, at which point the minions of Pastor, Brother, Governor, Reverend, Presidential Candidate, Diabetes, Snake Oil Cure Salesman Mike Huckstery looked at him and said, uh-uh, no. You can't come in here and be showing yourself off, acting like you the real God-loving presidential candidate. Clearly, Reverend, Brother, Governor, Pastor, Presidential Candidate, Diabetes, Snake Oil Cure Salesman Mike Huckstery is the real friend of Jesus in this race. Yeah, that's right. One friend of Jesus kept another friend of Jesus away from the Sister Clerk Kim Davis friend of Jesus rally. Mm-hmm. Jesus is not on trial at hearwomentalk.com. Read it. Share it about. By virtue of the considerable genius and talent of our very own dear friend, Carol Baker. Let's run over to the stress line, where I think we have the marvelously coherent Diane from Kansas stand. Hey, Diane. Just one second here. Hold on. Ah, there you are, I think.
You can hear me?
I hear you fine.
You sound muffled, but I think I can deal with it.
Okay, let me see here. Is that any better?
No. And you know, on the other line I called in on, it was like hearing you in a wind tunnel. But, I don't know.
Well, I think... No, that's way too hot. Hold on. Okay. Well, looky, it's another thing for us to work on the equipment fund, huh?
Yeah, it's a little garbled, actually, so... We can try to talk, but I'm not sure how it will work.
Why don't you talk, and I'll listen, and we'll listen, and if you lose anything I say, I'll happily repeat it.
Well, it is conversation radio. I hate to, you know, hog the line, but I can go over a couple of things.
Yeah, I just filibobstered for an hour and a half. I mean, it's time for somebody else to talk.
Well, I missed some of it because I was still teaching, and then when I got out of class, I walked around campus and listened to, I got in on the shuttle incident, the great shuttle incident of 2015. So it was very interesting. Gosh. Well, I have a couple things stored up from more on Monday. And one of them was brought to my attention by Mr. Ron in Canada, because I would have no clue what Kansas State marching band does in halftime. I mean, I wouldn't know. I would shield myself from such information. So, did you hear about it?
No.
Well, you know, I'm a little too ladylike to go into it in great detail. I need Zandra or Carol with me who can be more forthcoming because I'm a little shy. But, okay, so whomever Kansas State played recently, I'm blissfully unaware, but, you know, Ron make sure I knew about this. Bless him. K-State played South Dakota, perhaps. Someone. They played some group. And the marching band for K-State did this formation on the field that caught everyone's attention as being, well, first of all, it wasn't good sportsmanship, apparently, because they're playing, let's say, South Dakota, and they're making jabs at the KU mascot during halftime with the band formation. So I guess that's really not good sportsmanship. I really don't know. And then their formation was kind of off color. It looked off color to people. And it had to do with Star Trek. I hope you're pulling this up on your screen.
I'm trying. What?
I'm doing a really big... Ron from Canada owns this one. He should call in and explain it. Someone who knows sports should explain this. But we got an email from our president, the president of Kansas State today, saying that Kansas State has paid the conference $5,000. It will come out of the president's office account, and that the director of the marching band is going to be suspended for the KU, Kansas University game. And
okay, I think I've got it now. Hold on.
Yeah.
The Kansas State marching band formed the outline of a Kansas Jayhawk.
Yeah.
About to fillet the outline of a really large penis.
Well, see, that's where I wouldn't have known.
Although it was the Star Trek, it was the Starship Enterprise.
Enterprise.
It was the Starship Enterprise. It is also unmistakably phallic.
Really? Well, I wouldn't have known that. I wouldn't have even seen the video if Ron hadn't made sure I did. And I'm kind of giving a jab at Ron because, you know, I'm trying to keep myself blissfully unaware of the sports stuff. But then this hits the fan. And, you know, wouldn't you think that the band would forego doing anything about another team when playing a different team? I mean, I don't understand this. But anyway, so this came on the heels of Kansas State being in lockdown last week, you know, so one morning last week, which I emailed you about, because of armed men on campus. And so anyway, Kansas State has been in the news in these two ways, and the second one is one of my votes for moron.
Well, before we go to that, I just want to say that I wish your marching band would behave itself, because now the marching band at West Virginia University is bound to come up with something even more ridiculous. I mean, these things spread. A $5,000 fine is not going to slow down some act of guerrilla marching band tomfoolery.
Guerrilla marching band.
I've been doing this for a while, and never in my life did I ever expect to utter the words guerrilla marching and band in the same breath.
I can't understand you real well, but I'm hearing guerrilla marching band come through, and I think that's very descriptive. And
You understand me fine.
Well, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, I don't like sports anyway, but to me, I'm like, why make? I think this whole KU K-State rivalry, I put my head in the sand. I refuse to deal with it on any day-to-day basis because I mean, part of my family went to KU, part went to K-State. I went to neither. I headed east, you know, because it's just too much of a black hole. I can't be involved in such things. I don't mean just sports, but some contrived rivalry with people I would otherwise meet for coffee and wave to, and I don't get it. I don't get that whole thing. So I certainly don't understand having the mascot for KU out, formed on the field and for any reason. But anyway, that's the director of the marching band gets my vote for more on Monday. But he comes in second place to a gentleman I'm going to tell you about now, unless you have any more astute comments about this marching band business. Because I don't know if I described it well enough for the horn listeners, you know.
No, I think you did fine. But
yeah.
Can you hear me any better?
A little bit.
Yeah, okay, well.
You sound like you...
I went in the opposite direction and pulled back some of the gain on the mic.
Oh, yeah.
It was distorting.
I think it's better. Must be a lot going on your end and, you know, just getting back from a trip.
Well, I mean, it's just, it's a pain in the... Mm. It's never easy to engineer, produce, and do a program all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The band director, Frank Traz, issued a statement Sunday, and he said, and this is a quote, "There was absolutely no intent to display anything other than the Enterprise and the Jayhawk in battle." And that, as I'm sure you well know, Diane, is referred to as plausible deniability.
No, but I looked at the video, and that's all I saw was Star Trek and the mascot and the Jayhawk. That's all I saw. I guess everyone else saw something different. You're clearly seeing something different, so I yield to the better perception. Oh, how embarrassing for Kansas State.
We have to remember it was not a static display. It was moving.
Oh, I saw the whole thing. Yeah.
And maybe Diane, the prurient portion of your brain is simply not well-developed enough.
I think it's pretty developed. I just didn't see it. But that's because, it's probably because I don't care about sports. But since I'm hearing from, a friend in Canada calling my attention to it, I'm like, I put down my glass of wine. I turned off when I was watching Star Trek Voyager, and I looked at the video clip, and I thought, well, my God, what's happened to Kansas State? I mean, because there's another angle, because I read the reports of the perception of what it was. And I thought, the thing is, people love to think badly of Kansas. I mean, it's a thing, don't you think? Wizard of Oz and Phelps and, I mean, it's like, Kansas has its problems, but it's not that much worse than, it's not worse than some other places. But I think people like to think that people in Oz have gone off their rocker. And then there's this proof of it right in front of them with the marching band doing something totally unlinked to anything that should be going on that field. So that's my two cents worth. Have you ever seen anything like it?
I do love the fact, Diane, though, it's the responses of the university officials that are even better than social media. John Curry is the K-State athletic director.
Yeah.
And he said, "Our response has nothing to do with any perverted social media. Our response is solely the fact that we portrayed the disintegration of the Jayhawks by the Starship Enterprise."
Because
that can happen. Because there are giant Jayhawks. And there really are Starship Enterprises. So that's what he's concerned about.
Well, but Bob, I might be naive, but I can't imagine a whole marching band and the band director doing anything else in public. I mean, if it's bad judgment, I can't fathom it. I mean, it's not like a wardrobe malfunction. They're, you know, they're marching in a certain formation, and it's hard. It's difficult for me to believe that they would do that on purpose. I mean, I walk the marching band. People walk past my building at a certain time during the day, and I'm teaching class. The windows are open, and there's the marching band, and they're just wholesome looking kids. I swear to God, and I cannot imagine a marching band director putting his or her, I don't even know who it is, putting his or her reputation on the line. I don't get it. There's something about this I don't get. Have you ever seen anything like it?
You know what it reminds me of more than anything, Diane?
Oh, I can hear you now, by the way.
Lovely. Yeah. I have no idea what I did. I've twisted many knobs and sworn at a couple of others, but if you can hear me, that's wonderful.
Better, yeah.
There used to be a guy on Saturday Night Live who would do line drawings. Mm-hmm. And he would be telling a story, and he'd do the line drawing, and invariably it would wind up being something filthy.
Oh.
Just to kind of tweak the nose, because Saturday Night Live is live, just to kind of tweak the noses of the censors.
Oh. I can see that Saturday
Night. And that goes back to... I don't know if you remember or not, but when, I can't remember who it was on Saturday Night Live that used to do, Dr. Ruth Westheimer, and she did her to a T, but she would be doing a bit, and she would start out with her right index finger way the hell over here, miles away from her left hand.
Uh-huh.
And with her left hand, she would form a circle with her thumb and index finger, and over the course of the bit...
That wasn't Gilda Radner, was it?
No, it wasn't Gilda, because but Ruth Westheimer's post-Gilda.
Oh.
But she would eventually get that index finger within shouting distance of that circle, and whoever was... anchoring Weekend Update. Stop that. We can't have that. Oh, oh. And this is kind of that.
You think? I don't know.
I mean, it's obviously deliberately provocative.
I can't.
And you know what, Diane? It is a classic case of the old adage that it is easier to ask forgiveness than permission.
Yeah, I've done that one before for different things. I mean, why ask permission on every little thing? Just do it. I get that one on an individual level. I know that one. But my God, a whole marching band on apparently national TV, international, whatever. It goes out everywhere, right?
And you know what? They had to be quietly just absolutely tickled pink with themselves.
Well, then you understand this better than I do, because I assume people were embarrassed. I assume parents were calling in. I mean, these kids are from little towns in western Kansas. I would bet you a four-star French dinner that parents are calling. Seriously. I would. So I'm just assuming there is that angle for Kansas State. And, yeah, I don't know. If you think it's intentional, well then I defer to your better understanding of these things, and I thank Ron on the air for making sure that I know about this.
Huh.
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, it's his cross to bear. I mean, he's just trying to keep you in the cultural loop. But see, Sunday was the anniversary of the first airing in either 1976 or 1977 of Star Trek.
Do you think, was that game Sunday then?
No, the game I think was Saturday.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But still, it was that weekend, and no one would be more likely to know something like that than a band nerd.
I didn't really hear you, but I think you're probably saying that it's timed to correspond with that.
No. I said What I said was that no one would be more likely to know about an anniversary like that than, you know, a band geek.
Ron.
Well, no, than the people in the Kansas State band.
I'm sorry for filling in words you're not saying, but I'm straining to hear you. Well, I don't know. I just got back from a class where I was teaching ethics using Star Trek characters. I'm experimenting a little bit. And these kids, maybe one of them knew Star Trek. One.
Sure.
I don't know if these kids know Star Trek.
And you know, these rivalries exist all over the place. And David in South Carolina says that he could easily envision South Carolina and Clemson doing something similar with each other, or Alabama and Auburn, or Stanford and Cal, Oregon State. I mean, this, and you know, it's not hateful; it's good-natured tweaking.
So you're saying something that, okay? So I think I'm beginning to understand this. You're saying the extent of the rivalry would have overwhelmed better judgment because the rivalry is the norm. Someone has to explain this to me as if I'm 5 years old because I do not get it. I do not get the loyalty. I do not get it. In Pittsburgh, it was kind of okay. And I like the Steelers and my son's a Steelers fan. But in Pittsburgh, people didn't hang their whole identity on it. You know, there were other things to do, you know, like opera.
I don't know. I know some pretty diehard Steelers fans who hang a lot of identity.
Yeah. Well, in a town where it's 50,000 residents and when the kids are here it's 65,000, it overwhelms us. It overwhelms. I mean, literally on game day, I have a friend on the other side of this little town. I mean, so at its height, we're talking 65,000 people, maybe 70,000 with staff. But in the summer, it's all staff 49,000 or something like that. So, like on game day, I'll go on ESPN. I mean, I know enough to do that. Or I'll call my friend across town, and I'm like, just tell me when the home game is because I won't leave my house. Or I'll leave my house while everyone's in the stadium, but I want to be in my house when they empty out. It overwhelms us. So I think it's a little bit different. Yeah, I know Steelers. I was there. I taught downtown at the downtown campus. I mean, diehard fans, Penguins, Steelers, Pirates, but more the Steelers, don't you think? I mean,
Well, the Steelers and the Pens. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, once upon a time, there was a really, when Pitt was awesome, there was a pretty hardcore cadre of Pitt fans.
Basketball?
Football.
Okay.
Yeah. Back in like the Tony Dorsett years. But yeah, the Pirates are that way when the Pirates win. It's just been such a long time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we are far removed from Roberto Clemente and Willie Stargell and that whole gang, time gone.
Yeah, where I went to do my doctoral work, there was a place next door to our. We had a state-of-the-art college of business, but there was a. I guess it was near what had been Forbes Field or something, because I have a vague memory of walking up from that building, and walking on a thing on the pavement that was like a star or something with Clemente's name in it. Is that not right?
Oh, yeah. And there's a big, beautiful statue of Roberto Clemente at the ballpark.
Yeah. So that's what happened at Kansas State at halftime. I came into the faculty office today, and I'm like, well, you know, someone from Canada has to call me to let me know what's happening to our marching band at halftime. I'm just jabbing on Ron because, you know, otherwise I would have been blissfully, you know, ignorant, but we were all laughing about it, but, you know, it didn't really affect us that much. I think the band director's a moron, but, you know, I guess I could be talked out of that if, uh, if you think it's just, you know, business as usual. I don't know. I mean, the way it made the news, Bob, I'm not sure it was, you know, I think it went a little beyond what rivalries are usually about, don't you think so?
I'm not so sure. I'm prepared to make that statement.
Well, then I'm going to temper my response because, after all, I usually, well, after all, let's be honest, I do not know what I'm talking about. I mean, I'm around the marching band a lot because I walk around the stadium field when they're in the middle marching, you know, on their practice days, but that's about all I know. I'd like to nominate another moron that I have stronger feelings about.
Okay, well, do please continue then.
Well, okay, so just as a little bit of context, I'm in partnership with a couple of business executives, and they want to blog about some things. They really believe in ethics. And so I'm blogging some with them, and we're doing some podcasts. It's not really something we're launching big right now or anything, but they wanted me to do some blogs about ethics and using storytelling, you know, and that's not what I usually do. I do not write opinion people. I do not write opinion pieces or tell stories. I believe in storytelling. I just don't do it. I do theoretical, you know, articles with a statistical overlay or something, you know, but now I'm using storytelling. So I wrote a blog. Well, first of all, do you know about the American Psychological Association, the historical vote, where that association, the membership took back their power and banned their members from participating in torturing detainees? That was about a month ago.
Yes, yes, I do. Yeah. I'm aware.
Big deal. And I listened to it on Democracy Now, and they actually had audio of the vote, where the members were just ecstatic. And the only it was almost unanimous that membership voted no more participation in torturing detainees. One division, you could hear the representative vote no. It was the military division.
Well, of course.
Okay. So I wrote this blog where I created this legend, an ancient legend of a society where wisdom keepers and shamans and the military kept each other in check, and the wisdom keepers were key. Well, it was a legend where, you know, I'm associating shamans with psychologists, wisdom keepers with judges, and the military, you know, with the tribal warriors. Anyway, there's this legend, and then I skipped at the end of the blog to reports about from Forbes, from Business Week, about the APA members participating in torture. So I'm drawing a parallel to the ancient society, and then at the end I'm questioning what kind of a social contract is this, and just like the ancient society, the balance of power was thrown off. And anyway, I don't even remember everything I wrote, but I posted it on some LinkedIn groups, psychologist groups, including the global psychologist groups. You know, LinkedIn, they have certain discussion groups.
Right, right.
Okay. So I posted it, and, you know, I was getting several likes. It doesn't matter if people like it or not. It's just to provoke discussion, and I had updated the blog to show, I had written a postscript to the blog to you know, to update the blog about the APA vote that banned the torture. So, and congratulating psychologists in my own way, not directly, but saying this is a welcome development. Okay. So, and by the way, the membership, the social activists in APA, American Psychological Association, they had been active for years now in trying to get that vote, because what happened is the membership didn't want to be involved in torture, and the people at the top, the functionaries at the top, took over and rubber stamped it. You know, this is getting to be a common story, don't you think? These functionaries at the top don't listen to their members. I mean, I've been in professional groups like that, where they lead the membership astray. And anyway, my understanding is the Pentagon had to have the psychologists complicit, they had to have the psychologists be complicit to meet a legal standard within the executive branch. That's my understanding of it. And the doctors wouldn't do it. So, Bob, we're talking about psychologists do no harm. At minimum. I mean, the whole thing just, I had watched that with horror. So the APA, when the APA had that vote, I was very tuned into it. I was very happy about it. I updated the blog. And then recently, I got, you know, some psychologists have commented on it, and, you know, it's there to, spur discussion. Okay, so I'm going to try to pull up. Okay, here's this one guy who wrote a long comment about my blog. Do you think you understand what I'm writing about, right? I mean,
yes, I absolutely do.
Yeah, here's the title of my blog, Shamans, Wisdom Keepers, and Psychologists, Torture and a Missing Moral Compass. It's pretty clear what I'm writing about.
I want to read it.
Yeah, pretty damn clear. Well, okay, so here's this guy, licensed marriage and family therapist and author of Creator or something, I don't know, this guy. I see his picture, and he's commenting on my blog. These other psychologists have liked it. Like, they like the APA took back their power and everything. Okay, so I won't read this whole thing, but it came to me on Monday, and I'm like, this is just more on Monday. This is just, it just hit me the wrong way. Not because someone can't disagree with me. Someone, you put stuff out, people disagree. Academics know that. There's no problem with that. But he's going into various scenarios. A terrorist was discovered, and shortly before apprehension, these six members published a video warning the American imperialists that an imminent WMD attack was going to be carried out, and then he says, pick any city you want. And he raises a question, do we give these terrorists legal protection in order to appease our civil sensibilities and ideals, or do we apply waterboarding or chemical-based interrogation techniques to get this information from the captured terrorists?
Really? We're still there, Diane? Really?
Pardon?
I said, really? We're still there?
Yes, that's it.
This is the argument that predicated the creation of that god-awful television show 24.
Yes. This is LinkedIn. This is for psychologists. This is for professionals. I mean, I'm not saying everything on LinkedIn rises to the level I would want, because people are discussing things. But he goes on to say, I mean, and also, I think I identified myself as a professional ethics professor. Yeah, I did, when I posted this. So I don't know if he ever thought that I hadn't gone through the thought experiment of the utilitarian argument of doing something for the greater good while violating human rights. That's the oldest one in the book for an ethicist. You know what I mean? That's the oldest one in the book. I mean, that is something that we know comes up. We know there's a tension there. We know the arguments. But anyway, so he goes on to make that argument as if an ethicist hadn't thought about it.
One second, Diane.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who this respondent was, but I can.
He's from the military.
Sure, I was about to say, but I can say, with almost rock solid lead pipe cinch, bunny back guarantee, that the person is probably a he and an authoritarian of some sort. Because
family therapist. Maybe he's seen a lot of tortured people.
I can only imagine what a session must sound like. It's a line out of Woody. You know, it's a line from the Humphrey Bogart character in Woody Allen's
Play It Again Sam, you know, where the Bogart character says, I've never seen a dame who couldn't take a slap in the face or a slug from a 45.
Well, we are in a thought experiment now.
But on that side of the spectrum, they are cloaked with a level of with a hard shell of privilege that says that they can determine what you have and haven't done, regardless of what your own experiential basis is.
Well, you know, I didn't read this whole thing to you, but he's going to his, well, first of all, again, he's a licensed marriage and family therapist. And then he identifies himself as a U.S. Army officer, an LMFT. I don't know what that is. He has gone through SERE training. I don't know what that is.
Well, an LMFT is a licensed marriage and family therapist.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Ooh, what a combination. And in this SERE training, it's designed to give us the inner tools and methods to resist torture for as long as possible, including being subjected to newer techniques for acquiring information from individuals. So he's given me his bona fides. You know, he's
No, they're not really his bona fides. They are what he was doing, and I'm not trying to be crass and get back to the Kansas State Band or anything, Diane. He was waving his enterprise at you.
I did not expect you to make that comparison.
But that's how they do it.
Well, you know.
I mean,
I don't care about that
one. But one. I mean, this is for clarity's sake. We need to understand that if the people who have been through SERE training, SERE. If the people who have been through SEER, if the people who have been through Ranger School, if the people who are ex-spec ops warrant officers in the United States military, if everybody who claims that, who is on the internet, actually was, our military would have to be a 50 million person military.
You mean it's like claiming to have Cherokee blood or something? I mean,
it's exactly that.
Yeah.
Only with guns.
Yeah, only with guns. Well, I don't take this personally. I mean, he's polite. He's giving me scenarios and questions. And actually, it's not so much to me. I'm starting a discussion trend, discussion thread. You know what I mean? In a group called Global Psychologists. So I'm starting a discussion thread. He's responding, and what gets, and it's more to me. And I'm not discounting what you say, because he's claiming an expertise in this area, whatever. It's an area I think that expertise doesn't belong in the APA, and that's really my point. I mean, the membership didn't want it. The military, the small military division of psychologists did. The rest of the divisions, the many divisions, never wanted it. I mean, how fascistic is that? But anyway, he goes on, he goes scenario, question, issue, prevailing issue, conclusion. I mean, it's very systematic. His conclusion is...
Oh, he was marching on his computer keyboard.
He's a marching band. He's a one-man marching band. Is that what you're saying?
He's a squared away soldier marching up and down the square on his computer keyboard. Hoo-wah!
It really, what bugs me the most, I mean, I saw this and I thought, seriously, because I had posted to a higher education group a blog about using Star Trek to teach ethics, and man, did that discussion board light up. I was the top contributor. I don't care about this stuff. It's not what I normally do. But I was top contributor, manager choice. And people from all over the world were sharing their Star Trek, how they use Star Trek in classes in London and, you know, around the world. And technology professors were weighing in. And that's the kind of, you know, that's where I've been on LinkedIn. I mean, that's kind of good, vibrant Star Trek stuff, you know? And then there's this thing on another post, and he concludes, well, all the time he's saying human life has values, but he's saying, basically saying these terrorists decided to put themselves in this position. And then his conclusion is, perform waterboarding and chemical means to get the necessary information from the terrorists to save lives and prevent the attack in the first place. And then he says, new paragraph, cutting off fingers, electrocution, and etc. are proven to yield limited, unreliable results. Oh, well, that makes it clear. Oh. You know, so cutting off fingers, no, that's not going to be as good. He doesn't rule it out. It's just less reliable. I just looked at this thing and thought, oh, my God, I thought these people had crawled away somewhere. That's all. That was my, that's why I'm nominating him for moron. I just thought they were gone. How naive.
Oh, no, they're not gone. They're
nope.
No, the morons ye have always with ye. I think that's probably a better quote from the original Aramaic than the poor, from what Yeshua said. But secondarily, you get a sense doing that. You know, like when you mentioned Star Trek, and everybody went whoop, and everybody had a comment.
Everyone was on fire with,
That's my life, Diane. What was it, Friday night when I mentioned McDonald's going to breakfast all day and how that meant that I would never order anything but their sausage gravy again? And suddenly there was a great discussion over the relative merits of institutional fast food gravy.
That's interesting.
I could open the program with the story that our good friend Chris in Germany directed my attention to about the torment of a particular scientist who began pointing out that you know polar bears are going to go extinct because we're melting their habitat and this campaign against this individual inside the halls of government to shut down his research. And it's the story's at Salon, and it's a fascinating story. And you just kind of sit there going, oh my God. And I can do stories like that and it'll be quiet. I mention institutional gravy and my email goes bing, 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 bing.
Wow. Well, it's just safer to talk about. I mean, I enjoyed the Star Trek sharing because, I mean, whatever makes ethics come alive for students, I think Star Trek is like a compendium of possibility.
Well, Star Trek is and always has been a deliberate effort to have that conversation.
Exactly.
And becomes much more so even in the Next Generation series, I think.
In what? What did you say?
Well, you know, in the second series, in the Next Generation.
Oh, Next Generation, yeah. But, you know, Voyager has its moments. I'm sort of hooked on Voyager. Oh, my God. Because they're stranded in the Delta Quadrant. I think some of those things come into sharper focus. But anyway, you're saying that something like commenting on the state of gravy or a marching band, I mean, these things catch people's attention.
Well, because we are cultural animals, Diane.
Yeah, we're pathetic.
No, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We are cultural animals, and we like to discuss the things that sort of bubble to the surface of our culture. It explains our fascination with Sister Clerk Kim Davis, while tens of thousands of refugees are dying and starving, trying to come out of, you know, the it all by our lonesome selves, just about,
so,
in the Middle East.
To grasp that part of it, what you just said. The main people, I mean, I don't hear, the little I, you know, tune into mainstream media, people aren't really seeing that exodus of refugees as something we stirred up into.
Oh, no, because we're not going to tell them that, because that runs against the, I mean, for the for-profit media, Diane, that runs against the grain of our narrative of American exceptionalism.
Yeah, but
you know, because it's hard for the for-profit media to say, well, we have exceptionally screwed up the Middle East.
Yeah, I get that part of it. We're just in denial and PR stuff. But what I'm thinking is these nations like Hungary and Germany and Vienna and on, I mean, you'd think, I mean, they're announcing we'll take 1,000, you know, refugees. I mean, nations are announcing what they're going to do. You would think that different, somehow, and maybe it's just because I'm not getting enough international news, you would think that one of those nations would say, we'll do what we can, but America, since you start, I mean, they are saying, America, you need to do more. What I'm waiting for is the rest of that sentence, you know, the next clause, because you caused this. It seems like other countries would be pointing the finger, but maybe it's just all edited before I hear it on the
I don't think other countries can point the, okay, let's just sort of break this down for a minute, Diane. Other countries can't point the finger. Who can't point the finger? Syria and Iraq can't point the finger because they are in various forms of an existential struggle with fists around their throats, okay?
Yeah.
So they're a little busy.
Hungary,
Austria, the Balkan states, Germany, France, Sweden, they really can't address it because they're busy addressing the meat and potatoes on the ground issue itself of how do we meet the needs of these people,
right?
Or how do we? And a lot of this has centered on Hungary. Because they're the one country that has come up with the classic American jackbooted fist around the throat response.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
they're stamping people's arms or something.
So everybody's really too busy dealing with the tactical on the ground situation to deal with the overall strategic situation. Because they know the American response will be, "Well, it's you guys' problem, and this is no time for you to be playing the blame game."
We'll never get anywhere with that kind of dynamic. I mean, because other people are cleaning up our messes without even pointing to who caused it. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, it's ridiculous, but at the same time, I think the rational European states have come to the conclusion of what's the use in pointing at the United States? The United States is just going to be, you know, we're not. And you know, I was saying this way, way back. During when Iraq was turning pear-shaped, I was saying, you know, we need to get out of there, and we don't need to be trying to fix what we broke, you know.
Yeah.
That's Colin Powell's so-called pottery barn rule. We need to just get away, and if anything, we write the check and let competent people do it.
Yeah, I remember you said that. I clearly remember you saying that. Right, yeah.
There's very little percentage apart from maybe whatever this country might be able to obtain or gain from a little bit of navel gazing, and we don't and we just don't navel gaze that well.
The truth, yeah, I know. There's a reality here, and you know what country's going to go out on a little limb and offend the big giant in the room, but my God, it's just painful to watch, Bob. I mean, the truth is just this big thing called the truth is there, and no one.
Well, yes, it is, Diane, and you know what is even there's a larger truth here, and that is this: the United States of America, which and most people don't even know this history. Before the Marshall Plan happened, the proposal for what would later become the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe. The original request was for a much, much higher amount of money. But the conservatives said, oh, my stars and goddess, that'll break us. That'll throw us back into depression. Oh, what about the money, sir? And so the Marshall Plan was actually accomplished on a relative shoestring budget. But the reality we have to confront, those of us who are into confronting these sorts of realities,
is that the United States today is so far, far removed from the United States of 1945, 46, 47, 48. The United States of today could not accomplish the Marshall Plan. We are structurally, physically, and philosophically incapable of doing that kind of grand-scale operation. We simply cannot do it.
Well, after Katrina, I mean, we couldn't handle our own city, one of our own jewels of the city. Conservatism, it's a real disease.
Well, it is, and it'll eventually be the end of us.
You know, I was out to dinner Friday night with a small group, faculty and associate provost, who happens to be married to the mayor of the city. So we're talking about, you know, what's happened in Topeka, and the mayor of the city also teaches math to children, and she's sitting there talking about how, and one of the professors has three children in school here, and they're talking about how the parents are being told that in Manhattan, this is a pretty well-to-do place for faculty kids, and they're talking about how the schools here don't have paper to give the children to do their homework on. And so I turned to a friend of mine, he's a director of something at the university, and I said, I didn't turn to him. I announced at the table, who would ever admit to voting for Sam Brownback? And he raises his hand, and he says, I did. And I just said, I hope you're happy. I mean, I just said, I don't think I'll talk to you the rest of the night. And I just didn't know what to do, because he's a friend, and he's hearing his friends around the table talking about how their children don't have paper to do their homework on, but it wasn't just that he voted for Brownback. He was, like, glad he did. So I was like, well, yeah, and then that does it.
Yeah, and really, what other response is there? I mean, that's the thing. There's one, and you know this as an educator, Diane. It is one thing to be ignorant and seek to cure it. Then there's the other side of the coin, which is to be ignorant and to be proud of it.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know if this is going to sound... He's the only non-academic at the table. Now, doesn't that sound elitist of me? But, I mean, truly, he has minimal education. He's really good with technology. And you know, and so that... You know how you talk about Carson being able to cut on a brain that can't think? What kind of sentence did I just make? He can cut on the brain, but he can't think. Wow. You know, it's kind of like that.
He's a minimally educated, Ben Carson's a minimally educated meat mechanic.
Yeah, and this person, a friend of mine, under normal situations when I need software downloaded or something, and he's very helpful, I don't know how to police my response, because to me, he's just sold everyone's interest at that table down the river. Because we're all K-Staters. Our budget is in somewhat of a disarray. I mean, I'm pretty protected, and so.
But the thing is, Diane, you're making certain presumptions, if I dare say.
Yeah.
About people's ability to see, a bright line between a vote and what happens as a result of that vote.
Well, you know, sometimes
I don't know this guy. Did this guy vote for Sam Brownback because he's a God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian?
Well, I mean, and this guy is an ex-cop, and believe me, we have our go-rounds about that, okay? I mean, so, you know, if you heard the whole thing, you'd probably get a certain profile in your mind. And I try not to dwell on differences with people I work with. What does it get anyone, but we're sitting around the table, and Kansas State has felt the pain of these cuts. I mean, some more than others, and some people around the table have, I mean, the mayor is sitting there saying the city is suffering because we don't have the money from the state for our normal projects, okay? And so people around the table who are in positions of responsibility, an associate provost among a mayor, you know, are talking about the pain felt by children, by the city, by people at K-State, and I cannot square that with my friend sitting next to me, who's like, oh, I voted for Rombach and was happy about it. I can't do it. But you know what? I'm sure if all the Horn people were in the room right now, we'd all have a story like that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we'd all have a story like that about someone.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, so, third moron, he's the third one. And I better let you go. Bob, I hope I've been a decent conversationalist because I couldn't understand you at times.
Well, I'm so sorry about that. And I don't fully understand the cause of it. It's driving me a little bit batty.
Are you real close to the mic? I mean, you don't do that, I know. So.
Well, no, I get up on the mic, I get back from the mic, but
yeah,
I mean, I'm looking.
And I know you know all the tricks, so I don't know what to say. There's
something flawed in. This is just.
Well.
There's something flawed in the mix minus of the gizmo.
Oh, well, the other line I called in, you sounded like you were in a wind tunnel. So it was that line too. It was, you know, I called in first on the other line.
Yeah.
And then and so I don't know. It's like you just got back from a wonderful trip and. And the technology gremlins are waiting for you. I guess that's what happened. But welcome back, and it's good talking with you and getting your perspective on a couple things that I just, you know, it's difficult sometimes for me to grasp. You know, I don't always think of the obvious sometimes, so... marching band stuff.
Well, sometimes it's not so matter of not seeing the obvious as maybe Diane, you're seeing above the waves and not seeing the actual waveform action.
I don't know. The more it's explained to me, the better, because I do live in the world. So, you know, if people are. If that's normal football rivalry, I might as well know it. That's about all I can say. And I'm going to wish you a good evening because I've taken you right up to the end with my moron nominations. I really appreciate what you said about that psychologist because, man, was I ever steamed about that. Like, oh, really? You guys are still...
Well, I have... Diane, before we roll out of here, I have a response for you from Jack in Shreveport regarding the psychologist. He said, subject line, torture analogy. Is dude's proposition that the terrorists put themselves in that position the same as a woman wearing a short skirt asking to be raped or that a woman needing an abortion put herself in that position so forcing pregnancy is okay? The freaking point isn't whether the terrorists are bad or not. It's that we should want our country to be better than a nation that tortures. Screw that guy, Diane. You got it right. He's the hammer, and as such, he always has to have nails.
Thank you, Jock. What an analysis. And this guy is a family therapist. Thank you, Jack. Very, very astutely put. And, I know those people are around, but, you know, just kind of for them to blatantly come out in a, like that, when the whole APA has voted them down. So why don't they stay down? You know what I'm saying? They should just, they're like one of those clown things you blow up with a sandbag on the bottom. You just smack them hard and they pop right up. Like they weren't voted. It's as if he wasn't. It was as if the military division wasn't voted down with glee by the whole APA. No, they have to pop back up in the middle of psychologists arguing their point. That's what annoys me, Bob. That's what annoys me. But thank you, Jack from Shreveport.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you, Diane, and have a lovely evening.
You too, Bob.
Bye now.
Ciao.
The marvelously coherent Diane from Kansas Stan, and I'm going to work to try to solve this problem. I just don't quite know where to begin. It's a little frustrating. I hate having audio gremlins. It's time to get out of here. Thank you for your patient indulgence in my trip report, Philip Bobster. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you to Kate. Kate is the only one jumping in this evening to help out. Thank you very much indeed. We will begin the program tomorrow with $400 to raise. Because we at least caught up with the deficit this evening. Thank you very, very much, Kate. Thanks one and all to all of you who share your time listening to the program. Thank you for your thoughts, your ideas, your emails, your chats, your messages, the multitude of ways in which we communicate during these 3 hours. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thank you again to Sparky and to Kath from Canada for making this little mini-vacation possible. Thank you. Thank you very much to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox in Australia, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.